Today we're going to be starting our study of Parshat Korach. In case there's anybody who didn't get a chance to read through the entire Parsha yet inside, let's open up and start the Parsha together. Because we have, again, one of these more comprehensive source sheets, it's on the source sheet as well, but if you have a chumash in front of you, I would recommend looking in your chumash. The very beginning of the Parsha, which is also in source number one, Perek Tetzayin Pasuk Aleph. Vayikach Korach, ben Yitzhar, ben Kahat, ben Levi, v'datan v'aviram, b'nei Eliav, v'on, ben Pelet, b'nei Reuven. So Korach takes. What does Korach take in this Pasuk? Unclear. So some say that he took the rest of the pasuk. He took everybody who's listed in the rest of the pasuk. But it's actually not clear what he took, and we'll try to swing back around and give an answer to what it is that he took, and the Mefarshim try to explain it because it's not clear from the pasuk. But Korach comes and takes something. Vayakum lifnei Moshe. He comes up in front of Moshe. Vanashim ibnei Yisrael chamishim matayim se'ei da krei mo'ed anshi shem. And he brings with him 250 people who were leaders of the people. 250 people Korach brings with him. Vayikalu al Moshe ve'al Aharon, and they come and they gather against Moshe and Aaron. Vayamru, and they say, Alehem, Rav lachem, it's too much for you. Ki kol ha'ida, kulam kedoshim. Because this entire Eidah, this entire congregation, they're all kadosh. They're all holy. Uvituchah Hashem, and God is amongst them. Umadua titnas'u al ka'al Hashem. And why have you raised yourselves up over the congregation of Israel? Of Hashem. That's Korach's claim. And Moshe's response, Vayishma Moshe, Vayipol al panav, Moshe falls on his face before beginning to argue back. So we have this really sad parsha, again, in a long string in Sefer Midbar of challenging stories, of mistakes, of this very stormy book. After we had the falling out between the generation Dor HaMidbar and HaKadosh Baruch Hu in last week's Parsha, in the last Parsha that we did in Parshat Shlach, now we have seemingly the falling out between at least a significant chunk of the people and Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe and Aaron. And Korach comes and he challenges Moshe. What's the nature of this challenge to Moshe? What's the nature of this argument against Moshe? We just read it and translated it. Come on, somebody, anybody?
Rabbi.
It's too much for you. What does it mean it's too much for you? What's the issue?
Everybody's kadosh, and everybody has Hashem within them. Why are you the leaders?
So what's the argument?
Okay. Put yourself in charge, it's not fair.
What are you putting yourself in charge for? Why do you deserve to be at the head of the people? Now that argument can go in two directions. The seeming direction of the claim against Moshe is, why did you put yourself above the people? What should have happened based on this pasuk? Who should have been at the head of the people? Based on this pasuk?
Nobody.
It seems to be an argument for a more communistic approach, right? We're all equal. What's the problem with communism, though? Yes, correct. And everybody's equal, but... Thank you. Some people are more equal than others. So there's seemingly two things happening here. On the one hand, from the pasuk itself, is there's this argument for we're all equal, and who are you to put yourself above the people? This attack against Moshe, this attack against Aaron. But on the flip side, and following with communism's broken philosophies, there are some people who are more equal than others. And so what's the underlying claim that we all know from Korach, which is what one of you said before? What's really underlying Korach's claim? What else does he want?
Power.
He wants to be the one on top. So the argument then seems to be muddled. Is it that we're all equal and why is anybody up top? Or on the flip side, is he saying, why did you get to go up top and why am I not leading the people? We'll have to try to unpack what is this muddled claim of Korach. This muddled issue of Korach. In trying to understand what's going on with Korach, we also have to take a look at what the response to Korach is. A lot of times from the response to things, you can understand what the thing itself is. HaKadosh Baruch Hu always reacts, midah, keneged, midah. Measure for measure, everything is always equal and opposite, action, reaction. And so by looking at the reaction of God to Korach, we can also get a better understanding of what it is actually that was the nature of Korach's claim, of the issues that there were within Korach. Take a look a little farther down in the Parsha, same Perek Tetzayin Patsuk Chafchet, which is also in source number 2 on your source sheets. Vayomer Moshe, Moshe comes and says, Bezot Teidun, ki Hashem shelachani la'asot et kol ha'maasim ha'ila ki lo milibi. Through the following you will know that God sent me to do all these things, and that I didn't do them from my own heart. They didn't come from me. Which also you can almost hear beneath the surface, Moshe Rabbeinu, who must be so pained by this whole argument. Because what do you know about Moshe Rabbeinu? Moshe Rabbeinu, who is the leader of the people. Anybody have longer memories and can actually go back to when Moshe was told he was going to become the leader of the people? What was his response? Anybody else? Not just go get Aaron. He didn't mention Aaron. Just anybody else. Just not me. And they go back and forth and back and forth. God and Moshe. God and Moshe. So much so that God gets angry at Moshe and says, enough already. Take the position. And you can hear, well, I didn't want any of this. Nothing of this is of my own. I didn't ask to be in this position. I'm just here to give over what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants, like he told me to do. Im kemot kol ha'adam yimutun. Eile ufkudat kol ha'adam yipakir alehem lo Hashem shalachani. If you die a normal death, then God didn't send me, says Moshe. But, Pasuk Lamed, the Imbriya Yivra Hashem, but if God creates an entirely new creation, Ufatzta ha'adama et piha, and the earth opens up its mouth, Uval'autam, and swallows them up, Vet kol asher lahem, and everything that belongs to them, V'yardu chayim sha'ola, and they go down alive into the pit. Then, Vidatem ki niyatsu anashim e'ela et Hashem. That these people are really fighting against Hashem. What kind of response is this? When do we say that the response to an argument is to create something new, that the response even to a sin is that this whole new creation is going to come out? And the earth is going to open up and swallow them alive. What kind of response is this? So from both sides, we need to understand what's really going on, what's really the claim, the issue of Korach?
That everyone should be equal.
One thing, so we have to understand deeper, what is really going on with Korach? What's the nature of the punishment? How do the two fit together? We have a lot to unpack. What's really at the heart of this? In most of the Balei Hashkafa deal with in this parsha, there's really one kind of key word in this parsha that's what gets discussed. What's that word, which you've already said in English quite a few times already? What's the word that underlies Parshat Korach, the story of Korach? Bigger word, bigger concept.
Jealousy.
All of the things that you said that we're going to come back to. But the word is, Machloket. That when we really want to talk about what Machloket is, what Machloket is about, this is the parsha that's most often brought up and where it's most often discussed. Because there's a Machloket here between, seemingly, Moshe and Korach. And that becomes the heart of this story, of the story of Korach. What we're going to do today is we're going to examine this concept of Machloket. And then Bezrat Hashem on Wednesday, we're going to take everything that we've developed today and we're going to plug it back into these questions in our Parsha. Clear? But first we're going to take a step back and try to understand what this issue of Machloket is. This concept of Machloket is really about. And to do that, we're going to go to one of the primary sources on Machloket, Mishnah Pirkei Avot, which unsurprisingly links into Parshat Korach. It's in source number 3 on your sheets, Mishnah Pirkei Avot, Perakei, Mishnah Yedzayin. Kol Machloket shi l'shem shamayim sofa l'hitkayim, says the Mishnah. Any Machloket, which is l'shem shamayim, in the end it'll be mitkayim, in the end it will stand. There's a lot of things already that we need to understand here. What is the nature of a machloket? Also, what makes a machloket l'shem shamayim? How does one know if a machloket is l'shem shamayim or not? And what does it mean if any machloket that's l'shem shamayim so falihit kayim, in the end it will stand? What does that mean that it will stand? It will stand as a machloket? It will become resolved? If it becomes resolved, so then how do both sides of the machloket stand? What does it mean, sofa lehit kayin? How do we understand that? And the flip side of that, the Mishnah is parallel. V'she'ina l'shem shamayim, and a machloket that's not l'shem shamayim, ein sofa lehit kayin. So the two key pieces here seem to be, is it l'shem shamayim or not? So what is l'shem shamayim and what's not l'shem shamayim? We have to figure it out. And second of all, what does it mean to be mit kayin? What does it mean that a machloket is going to be mit kayin or not? So we're going to need an example of each to examine, to work with, to understand. Says the Mishnah, Ezo hi machloket shi l'shem shamayim. What machloket is the paradigmatic machloket l'shem shamayim? Zo machloket hilel v'shamay. If you want to know what's really a machloket l'shem shamayim, really a machloket l'shem shamayim, a machloket that sofa l'hitkayem, look no further than hilel and shamay. On the flip side, v'she'ena l'shem shamayim, a machloket that's not l'shem shamayim, Zo machloket Korach v'chol adato. That's the machloket of Korach and his congregation. What is Hillel and Shammai? Who are they, and what makes them l'shem shamayim and sofa l'hitkayem? Who are Korach and their Aida? That they're not sofa l'hitkayem, and also there's a lack of parallel that just sort of fell apart. If you missed it, take a look at the last two lines of that Mishnah again. Something doesn't add up, and all you have to do is count to two.
Right, because
yes, Isam.
The first one has Hillel and Shammai.
It's Hillel is one side of the machloket. Who's the other side? Shammai. Machloket Sheinu L'shem Shammayim. We have Korach and his Eida, and
no, that's it.
And a deleted word from the Mishnah. Like what happened? Zo Korach v'chol adato. Yeah, Korach and his Eida were one side. It should have said what should have been the end of the Mishnah. Korach v'chol adato ve Moshe. Where's Moshe? So it's very cryptic in terms of what does it mean that this was a machloket shein l'shem shamayim? Where's the whole other side of the machloket? What's happening in this Mishnah that it lacks that parallel? I'll have to explain that as well. So again, let's take it one step deeper and continue to examine the origins of machloket itself. What's the earliest source of machloket that we have? Not Hillel and Shammai, not Korach v'Adato. There's the earliest origin going back to Parshat Bereishit. Even earlier in Parshat Bereishit. Even earlier in Parshat Bereishit. Chazal identified the first machloket that ever existed. Excellent. Day two of creation. If you take a look in source number four. Vayomer Elokim, Yihi Rakia Betoch Hamayim, Vayihi Mavdil Bein Mayim Lemayim. That God on the second day of creation divides between the upper waters and the lower waters. That which is the water as we know it, in the oceans, around in the seas, and whatever this upper waters are. But the upper waters and the lower waters split. And we have this divide. It's not surprising that this comes up on day number two. Because that's also very much what day number two and the number two itself is about. Can use, we're going to borrow terms from English, from some of your English classes. Maybe. My English classes, they were part of it. That number one, and we can even understand it in the way that it's presented in Chumash. On the first day of creation, I know this is hard to think back two parshas ago in the cycle of the parshiot, but it says the beginning of the Torah, at the end of the first day, Vayi erev vayivoker yom echad. What does echad mean? What was the alternative choice? Rashi talks about it. Rishon. What does Rishon mean?
First.
Why does the Torah choose echad and not Rishon? How many days are there going to be? Not a trick question. Seven. So it's the first of the 7 days. But that's not entirely true. Because on day one, what is it? It's just one. It's not the first of anything. You only have a first when you have two. So one stands on its own. By Erev Boker Yom Echad, there only is one. One is the presentation of a thesis, an idea, a concept that stands on its own. We did this in Shir Kali in the summer. Yeah. Shir Kali in the summer. Not in your English class. Thesis. Then we produce the second thing. Then you have something that comes and is produced that becomes Sheni, the second, and therefore is by definition in contrast to, in conflict with that first thing. Thus making it an, if you were to emphasize it would be an antithesis. If you were to say it properly in English, you would call it antithesis. One is thesis and two is antithesis or antithesis. And so those two things come against each other. And they produce a machloket. And that's reflected in the very nature of what's produced on that day. Is that you have one thing which is divided into two. Nothing new is even produced. The two things are divided into each one with their own identities now. But the two pull apart from each other. And we have this thesis and this antithesis. And the Medrash brings this out. Take a look in source number 5. The Medrash picks up on the fact that in day number 2, there are two words missing that exist by every other day in creation. And those words are Kitov. There's no mention of Kitov by day 2. So the Medrash says, why is that? Source number 5. Lama in Ketiv b'sheni Kitov. Why on the second day doesn't it say Kitov? So one explanation. First it says, Lefi shebo nivra gehinom. Because Gehenna was created on the second day. Shne'emar ki aroch me'etmol tifteh. Yom sheyish bo etmol velo shilshom. So it has a drasha to understand a day that had a yesterday and that's going to be day 2. V'chulei, fine. It says that on day 2, that's when Gehenna is created. And we're going to actually come back to that next year. I didn't underline it, but I've thought about it more and I think that it is very relevant to the concept of what's happening with Korach and Zedah. We'll come back to that next year. Rabbi Chanina Omer, this is the second underline, shebo nivra machloket. The reason why there's no Kitov on the second day of creation, says the Midrash, is because Machloket was created on that day. Shebo nivra Machloket. Shne'emar vayihi mavdil bein mayim lemayim. And goes even farther to say, Uma Machloket shu letikuno liyushuvot shel olam in ketiv bo Kitov. The Midrash goes on and explains a lesson from this. And we see that if even by its situation where this Machloket is for the purpose of fixing and establishing the world itself, it doesn't say Kitov, Machloket irbuvo shel olam, alachat kam vacham, even more so, kal vachomer by a Machloket that's only meant to destroy the world. The Medrash is even saying, it doesn't say Kitov by this Machloket, when this Machloket was part of creating the world. It doesn't matter. If it's a Machloket, there's no Kitov. Kal vachomer by a Machloket when the goal is destruction. When the goal is to really pull things apart, to divide them. But we have a tikkun. We have a tikkun. Davar acher shelo nigmara melechat hamayim. Lefikach kitiv bashlishi shnei pa'amim kitov, says the Midrash. Where did the kitov of the second day go to? Where does it show up? Where does it appear? On the third day. And take a look inside in source number 4 in the pesukim themselves. The two underlines. In pasuk Yud, it says, Vayar Elokim Kitov on the third day. In Pasuk Yud Bet, it says, Vayar Elokim Kitov. We have Pamayim Kitov on the third day. What is it about 3 that's going to do that? Because that's what 3 is about. 1 is thesis. 2 is antithesis. What's left with 3? We're maintaining our base word. Excellent, Eliora. Synthesis. 3 is all about finding balance between the thesis and the antithesis to come to a synthesis. To bring things together. To join together those opposites. There are always going to be things that are pushing and pulling in reality. There are always going to be thesis and antithesis. There's always going to be machloket in reality. And when a machloket stands as a machloket, it is inherently not tov. It inherently lacks tov. But if those two warring sides can come together and unite and draw from a source higher than themselves, than the two sides of that argument, to draw down into the world new life, a new reality, a new perspective that synthesizes the two, that balances the two, to create something new that takes both sides into account, then retroactively, it makes that machloket tov. Retroactively, the word tov can chal on that machloket, can chal on that reality of having these two opposites, pulling at each other, drawing at each other. Because they, in that machloket, it's utilizing that machloket to draw from a higher place and to bring out new life. In my humble opinion, I think that's very much reflected in the third day itself. What gets produced on the third day? Grass, cheese, before then even dry land itself. The dry land emerges between the two. And like you said, then we get grass and trees and vegetation. Literally from that unification of the lower and the higher, the lower waters and the upper waters, the sea produces the land. And whether you want to say it's going to be the rain or the sky or the atmosphere, whatever it is up above. But between those two, a new reality then comes forth and literally produces new life. That synthesis of the two, not denying each one, but them coming together, creates a reality of life in the vegetation. And that gives it a reality of kitov. On the flip side, where do we have it even defined in the creation story itself where something isn't tov? Excellent. Eliza just quoted source number 6, Bereshit Perek Bet Pasuk Yudchet. Vayomer Hashem Elokim, Lo Tov Heyot Ha'adam Levado. It's not good for man to be on his own. When man was on his own, it should have been definitionally Tov. It should have been fine. But there was no potential for creating this synthesis by himself. And so what does God do in order to create this potential? Brings in a second. But what does the second accomplish? Antithesis. The second accomplishes antithesis. And I'm willing to say this very confidently, you will find no greater opposites in reality than a man and a woman. You won't. You won't. And it makes absolutely no sense by pure logic that those two beings would ever come together. Totally different vantage points, totally different perspectives, totally different relationship to reality, totally different goals in reality, even though they're both part of humanity. Thesis and antithesis. And what's the demand on that thesis and antithesis? To create synthesis. And when a husband and a wife come together and create that reality of synthesis, they literally themselves bring new life into the world. They produce a child, which contains part of, on a genetic level, the genetic realities of one, and part of the genetic realities of the other, to bring new life that literally synthesizes the two. It's an incredible thing. Thesis and antithesis producing synthesis, a new life. And as we said before, drawing from a higher source in order to accomplish that. I suspect, and this is a well-quoted Rashi, but a Rashi that a lot of people struggle with, that that's actually the end of the same pasuk. Back in source number 6, Vayomer Hashem Elokim lo tov heyot adam levado, eselo what? What am I going to make for him? Eselo? Ezer kenegdo. So Rashi says on the spot, Zacha ezer lo zacha kenegdo li lachim. So it's often, I think, very unimpressively understood as meaning, if the man is Zoche, if he merits it, then he's going to get an Ezer. So who all of you in this room end up with depends on whether he's a good guy or not a good guy. You have no part in this at all. You're just pawns to move around on the board. Right? That's clearly what Rashi means, and that's clearly what Judaism believes. Clearly. I don't know who came up with that. Probably a man. Lo zacha kenegdo lilachem. And the person is not zochet, and then you'll fight with him. You also have no choice about shalom bayis. You're destined to fight with your spouse if he's not zochet. So you could understand it like that. You'll probably have a very bad marriage. Could understand it like that. I would claim the following, that it builds exactly into this point. I'm looking with this in mind when I was reading this Rashi. I was like, I think this is what Rashi is actually trying to bring out. Zacha Ezer. That the goal of the marriage is that the two of them, each for each other, is meant to be an Ezer. Because if the two assist each other, if these two opposites come together and assist each other, if they see two opposite sides that are unified, then that's going to produce new life. Lo zacha, and if not, kinegdo lihilachem, then there's a guarantee here that there's going to be a war in the house. If they're not looking to create a synthesis between the two, there are two divergent perspectives, there are two divergent worldviews. There are two different realities. If there's no attempt to, there's going to be a war. It's not going to be shalom bayis. It's going to be the opposite, lo aleinu. And what I was thinking is as follows. Take it or leave it. Definitely reading it into Rashi, but I think it's right there. That the word in Hebrew, zach, doesn't just mean merit. I'm not sure what merit means, even. What does zach also mean in Hebrew? To purify. I think, and we'll swing back to this to explain it as we go forward to Machloket. I think that what it's claiming is, zacha, ezer. If a person purifies themselves of their own selfish perspectives and is not only looking about their side of the argument, their side, their perspective, and each one is able to purify themselves, then they will support each other. Lo zacha, if one, it's putting the responsibility on us. It's speaking to the man in particular in this context because he's the only one who exists so far, but it's on both sides. Lo zacha, that they don't purify themselves and their perspectives and their worldviews, kenegdo, guaranteed to be against each other, lilachim. There will be a war. There's going to be machloket. It's going to be machloket that's going to turn into war. But again, we'll come back to these concepts. I think that's what's happening here in this Rashi. But in any event, what we've established so far, is that, again, from the second day of creation, we see that there are these two opposites. It gives the birth to machloket, and if that machloket produces synthesis, then it's tov. If it doesn't produce synthesis, it's low tov. If it doesn't produce synthesis, it has no tov at all, and it's just a machloket. Taking it even a step back, away from a husband and a wife. Let's even talk about the context of a chavruta. We have two people learning in the Beis Medrash. And they start arguing. They can be arguing in two different types of ways. They could either be arguing, they could either have a machloket that's l'shem shemayim, or they could have a machloket just l'shalot l'shem shemayim. What's a machloket that's l'shem shemayim? A machloket that's between two chavrutot, for example, that's l'shem shemayim. That machloket is they're both sitting there and they're learning and they're working on what they're learning and they're trying to understand. And one person takes one perspective and one thing, and the other person sees the psukim or the Rashi or the Ramban or the Radak or the Mishnah or the Gemara or whatever they're learning, they see it the other way. And they're arguing and both see them differently. But you can tell if the machloket is that they're both trying to find the emes. They're both trying to find the truth. That's a machloket, that's the Shem Shemayim. But many times, you'll watch chavrutot arguing, and it's not l'shem shemayim. What would be a not l'shem shemayim motivation when chavrutas are arguing? Excellent. I mean, not excellent, but excellent, right? They want to be right. They're not fighting for the truth. They're fighting for themselves. And it's very hard. It's a hard temptation not to fall into. We're sitting there over this Gemara and we're arguing and we're arguing and we're arguing and I'm taking this perspective and that's exactly. And 15 minutes into this machloket, I come to a very frightening realization. I'm totally wrong, right? Rebecca's like, I'm with you. I'm totally wrong. But for 15 minutes, I've been sitting here and yelling and screaming and arguing and fighting and trying to explain that it's like the way that I see it. But I realize that this realization, I'm wrong. And if I say, you know what? You're right, I'm wrong. You know what I just said? That for the last 15 minutes, I was yelling and screaming about something that doesn't even exist. I'm going to feel small. I'm going to feel stupid. And that's really hard. See what I'm going to do? He's not as smart as I am. I'll just keep pushing and pushing and pushing, and eventually he'll see it my way. Doesn't matter if it's right or wrong. But I'm not going to accept a loss here. Machloket she'eino l'shem shamayim. That's machloket for me. That's a machloket about me. That's machloket so that way when I come home at night and I look at myself in the mirror, I can feel good about myself. But it in no way reflects a pursuit of truth. That's a machloket she'eina l'shem shamayim. And when chavrutot come together, they're supposed to see things from different ways. It's not something that can happen. It's something that should happen. That's source number 8. Two relatively parallel Gemaras, one in Talmud Bavli, Masechet Brachot. The source that I gave you, just the phraseology is a little clearer. So it's from the Talmud Yerushalmi, also Masechet Brachot. It says, "Kishem she'ein partzufehen domin ze laze." Just like you have no two human faces that are similar one to another. "Kach ein da'atan domet ze laze." So too are their minds, their perspectives, their way of viewing reality are not similar. The Gemara says this. Every single person has a unique face, has a unique manifestation in this world, even if you have identical twins. Anybody here know identical twins? If you know them well enough, can you tell them apart? Of course you can. Because if they're two people in reality, they have two different goals, two different purposes, two different perspectives, and says the Gemara, that's reflecting in the very fact that their faces are structured differently, that they manifest in this world in two different ways. Because their perspectives are different. And we're meant to funnel Torah into this world through our perspective. Our goal is zacha. Our goal is to make sure that we purify ourselves, that all that we're bringing into this world is the perspective of truth that we have, and not the perspective of ourselves. But when one says with a chavruta, if you agree on everything, you should find a new chavruta. That's not a good chavruta. It means that the two of you are actually not on the same wavelength. Because if you both of you really think that you always agree, it means you have no idea what the other one is saying. You should be arguing with your chavruta. You should be seeing things differently. You should be producing synthesis. Not putting your hands around each other, singing kumbaya, producing thesis. Nothing happened. Because you should have two different perspectives. You should both be adding to the table. You should both be adding to the chavruta and working l'shem shamayim to produce that new reality, to draw from a higher source and bring forth new life. Eitz chayim hi l'machazin gebat, it's a tree of life for those who grab onto it. It should be producing new life when you learn Torah. That's what we're trying to do. And that comes through the back and forth of those chavrutot. As long as it's focused on being l'shem shamayim. Coming back to Hillel and Shammai, they were l'shem shamayim. Their whole reality of machloket was l'shem shamayim. And we even see that reflected incredibly in the Gemara Nesachet Erevin in source number 9. Amar Rabbi Abba Amar Shmuel. Shalosh shanim nechleku Beit Shammai uBeit Hillel. There was a 3-year machloket between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. It took them 3 years to come to a resolution on this point. You know what that point was? You know what nuance halakha that was? Says the Gemara. One side said the halakha is like us. And the other side said, you know what the other side claims? Yeah. The halakha is like us. In my humble opinion, I strongly suspect that there's also a hint to our discussion in that opening line in of itself. How long were they arguing for till they came to a resolution? Isn't that interesting? That in the third year, they came to a resolution. When you came to that reality of synthesis, I suspect that that's why it took till the third year to come to a resolution. So what was the resolution? They were fighting. Halacha is like me, halacha is like me. Yatza bat kol v'amra bat kol, of heavenly voice came out and said, Eilu ve'eilu divrei Elokim chayim hein. Both of these are divrei Elokim chayim. Both of these are words of the living God. V'halacha kibet Hillel. And the halacha is like Beit Hillel. What was the resolution of the Gemara? What is the resolution of the Bat Kol? Who's right?
Beit Hillel.
I heard two different things, which is great, because the answer is both. On the one hand, they're both right, because Eilu ve'Eilu divrei Elokim chayim. But yet, says Rebecca, but you, Liora, you didn't read, you stopped in the middle of that sentence. It said Beit Hillel was right. So which one is it? And the answer is both. Also, an important hashkafic point to take in is that down here in this world, in the physical world that we live in the finite world that we live in the realm of psak, there are two options, and we need to choose. Are we going one way? Or are we going the other way? Because we can't do two actions simultaneously. If Beit Hillel paskins to do something one way, and Beit Shammai paskins doing something the other way, you can only do one of the two. Which one is it? So we have to have a psak. But that only exists in the realm of psak. In psak, you need to have one or the other. And the answer is halacha ke Beit Hillel. In almost every circumstance, the halacha is like Beit Hillel. But what's the line before it, Eliora? What were you linking into? Eilu ve'eilu divrei Elokim chayim. That's only in a reality of psak, and it's something we lose sight of in this day and age where most of the Torah learning that happens in the vast majority of Batei Medrash, that certainly we have a relationship to, are very focused on psak. But what do I do? But what's the halacha? And that's an important question to ask. I'm not negating that point. But we get so focused on desperately trying to figure out who's right, who's wrong. It's not just what do we do and what don't we do. We need to know what to do. Who's right and who's wrong? Eilu ve'eilu divrei Elokim chayim. Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai can both be right. When you're drawing from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when you're drawing from the infinite, you can have multiple layers of truth. You can have multiple aspects of truth. Two people who are different are going to funnel truth into them in two different ways. We can only pask in one way. But we have two different realities of truth. Not opposing truths. We then have to work to figure out how are they synthesized. Not necessarily in psak, but philosophically speaking. Theologically speaking, how are these bringing out two facets of one ultimate truth in their two different piskei halacha? And it's amazing why the Bat Kol says that we focus on Beit Hillel, that we paskin like Beit Hillel. The Gemara says, "V'chi me'achar she'elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim." If both of them are true, "Mipnei ma zachu Beit Hillel likvoa halacha kemotan?" For what reason did Beit Hillel merit that the halacha should be by them? And I wonder if, again, what word do we see here pop up again? Zacha, which I think could also be understood the way that we explained it. In what way did they purify themselves that their perspective somehow reflected a greater truth for psak as well? Could be. Derech Afshar. But either way, how did they merit that they should be the ones to have the halacha, like them? Misha nochin ve'alu bin hayu. They were pleasant in their ways. They may have argued, but they were always pleasant. V'shonin divrehem v'divrei Beit Shammai. Whenever Beit Hillel would say something, they would quote their opinion and Beit Shammai's opinion. Was it a machloket? Yeah. But how are they relating to that machloket? As a striving for emet. They were looking for truth. And understanding that they could be right, they could be wrong, and trying to struggle it out. Because the only thing that mattered was truth, not themselves. The little odes, the Gemara finishes off, not only that, Ela Shemakdimin Divrei Beit Shammai LeDivreihem. They would first quote Beit Shammai, and only after quoting and explaining Beit Shammai, then they would explain their own opinion. So halachas like them because they knew how to relate to a, not that Beit Shammai didn't, but that even more so, they knew how to relate to a machloket and make sure that machloket was what? L'shem Shammai. And therefore, says the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, therefore, sofa l'hikayim, then both sides will stand for eternity. And whether one understands that to mean that the psak in this world is like Beit Hillel and the psak in the next world is going to be like Beit Shammai, or like we explained it in a little bit more of a nuanced way, that both of them are true, but it only expresses itself in psak one way, but both ultimately are true in their essence. They both reflect different aspects of an ultimate truth. Either way, That's a machloket that the same shemayim, and that's what it means. So far lehit kayim. Again, coming back to this concept and raising it back up a notch. So a husband and a wife, it's the same thing. That when a husband and a wife can argue, they are going to argue, and they can and should disagree about many things. Many things. Whether it's where they live, whether it's what school they send their kids to, whether it's what they're going to have for dinner. They're going to have different perspectives. Different reasons why they want what they want, or why they're saying we should do the things that they want to do. The question is that machloket l'shem shamayim, or is that machloket coming out of pure selfishness? And if it's coming out of l'shem shamayim, so fal hitkayim, then that house will stand for eternity with shalom bayit. Zahu ezer, they're each going to help each other come to a resolution. They're going to come to the best choice possible for their child to go to school, to the best choice possible about where they can develop their home and which place they should live. The best choice possible of which cuisine even they should choose. But zacha ezer. Lo zacha, if they didn't purify themselves, if they're only fighting from their own selfish perspective, if they're only fighting for themselves, then forget about it. The end is going to be milchama. Machloket she'ena l'shem shamayim, ena sofali kaim, it's not going to stand. It's going to be destroyed. As Rashi puts it, there's going to be milchama, there's going to be war. The end. Game over. It's an incredible thing to think about. It all comes down to where the person's coming from and how they're funneling that truth in. We'll give a little bit of just a hint in the last minute of how this is going to link back into Korach as well. Although we can already see where this is headed. And then we'll develop this in the next shiur. What's the end of that Mishnah Berkei Avot? What's that last line again? Izui machloket she'ina l'shem shamayim. What's that machloket? Korach v'chol adato. How did we define a machloket that's she'ina l'shem shamayim? What is the machloket that's she'ina l'shem shamayim? When you're fighting for yourself. So who's the only person mentioned at the end of that Mishnah? Korach. Because the other side was irrelevant. Korach didn't care about the other side. Not only that, when you bring together a group of 250 selfish people, all fighting for one cause, you know what cause each of them is really fighting for? They're all fighting for me. But now what's the problem? You just brought together 250 people who are all fighting for me. But it's not the same me. And therefore, where is the machloket? Korach v'chol adato. They were arguing with each other. They all wanted greatness for themselves. They all wanted their own perspective to win out. They were all fighting against Moshe and Aaron for their own selfish reasons. Moshe was irrelevant to the conversation. Because it was a machloket she'ina l'shem shamayim. It was a machloket that was selfish. It was a machloket that was personal. It was a machloket that was out of ego. We'll see, it was a machloket that was out of pain and directed in the wrong direction. That's where you're coming from? So then what's the conclusion? Ein, eina, sofa l'hitkayim. There's no standing for them. Literally. And what happens?
They fall into the pit.
There's no ground beneath their feet. They no longer stand. They no longer exist. They no longer have kiyum. The end. It's a very powerful concept. We have just scratched the surface of what was going on with Korach. We're going to go back into this story and take all of the things that we've talked about Machloket and integrate it much more fully, Bezrat Hashem, next year. For now, between now and Wednesday, to think about this concept of the fact that we all have our own unique perspectives, that we're all meant to bring different reflections of truth into this world, but in a way where we're only reflecting ultimate truth, and working to work with each other to find that synthesis, that with our differing perspectives, we're able to unify into back into that oneness by bringing out different facets of it, that we unify together in a reflection of that oneness in this world. Bezrat Hashem. Mm-hmm.